Of all the great ballerinas who've been associated with George Balanchine, there's something especially haunting and almost mythic about Tanaki Leclerc. But she was tragically struck down by polio and paralyzed at the age of 27, never to dance again. For those who've despaired of ever having been able to see her, well, now you can, thanks to Nancy Bersky's moving documentary Afternoon of a Faun, which premieres tomorrow at the Eleanor Bunin Monroe Film Center at Lincoln Center, and I'm very pleased that it brings Emmy and Peabody Award-winning director and producer Nancy Bersky back to our show. Hi.
It's wonderful to be here again.
When did you first hear of Tanny, as everybody called her? What was it in particular that intrigued you about her?
Well, I was seeing a documentary made on Jerome Robbins, Something to Dance About. And there's a short chapter in there on Tanny. They called her Tanny. That was her nickname. And I literally fell head over heels. She seduced me.
Well, you didn't see her perform live.
Never.
When did she come down with polio? It was quite
a
while back.
She was stricken in 1956 when she was 27 years old, so that would have been too early for me to see her. But I had never seen any footage of her either. She really did keep a very private life, and especially after she was stricken, she really kind of receded from the spotlight.
How would you describe what she looks like dancing for all those people who haven't had a chance to see her? Was she all that different from some of the other great ballerinas?
She was very different from the ballerinas who preceded her. She had very long legs, very long arms, a long neck. They would describe her as having a racehorse physique. And prior to that, Balanchine's dancers especially were rather short, and they moved quickly. So she was unique.
And then he liked tall dancers after that.
Exactly. She became the prototype for the Balanchine dancer. And many other dancers who followed looked very much like her.
Jacques d'Amboise called her an elongated, stretched-out path to heaven.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
And he was partnered with her a lot, and he appears in your film.
Throughout the film, he's one of our four or five narrators in the film, and he danced with her all the time. In fact, he studied with her at the School of American Ballet. He was a couple of years younger than Tanny.
Did she have a different kind of movement? Does Barbara Horgan, who was Balanchine's personal assistant, says in the film?
You know, I think Balanchine exploited that very unusual physicality. And as Jacques says in the film, she covered space. So there was something about those long legs and those long arms that made it seem as if she was reaching to the heavens.
But it's not just the way the fact that she was long, tall and thin. Is it fair to say that there's something both seductive yet unaffected and witty about her?
More than fair. It's quite accurate.
She
had quite a personality on stage, and it came through in her dance. Many people said that not only was the music inside of her, but the characters she danced were inside of her. And so there was a presence on stage that you don't see with many dancers today. I think that's why a lot of dancers look up to her so much, because she embodied her parts.
But because she was different from other dancers, she seemed to have had some trouble in school. And it was only when Balanchine saw the potential that changed?
I think the spirit is what came through. In school, she was very willful, and one of our narrators actually called her ornery because she got kicked out of school. And Balanchine saw her standing outside the classroom with her arms firmly crossed, and he said, "Why are you not in class?" And she said, "Kicked out." And he said, "What's your name?" And she said, "Tanny."
How difficult was it for you to find footage of her?
I was concerned about that for two reasons. One, ballet footage is in those days was rare. People didn't videotape it as they do today. So I started the hunt very, very quickly and did begin to find footage of her dancing. But my other concern, of course, was finding the footage of her after she stopped dancing. Having been such a private person, I was very concerned we wouldn't find it. But we did.
Well, some of the footage is pretty nice, and others, often, I guess, from kinescopes on television shows, when television shows actually would feature ballet dancers, it gets a little fuzzy. So was there a lot of work to make it usable?
Well, yes, but on the other hand, we also accepted that vintage look, and we knew that it added to the aesthetic of the film, and we felt that it was actually serving the film in an interesting way. That along with the score, the music that we used, I thought all contributed to putting us back in history, making us feel like we were seeing Tanny at that time.
Well, how did you even find it? Did you I'm sure you had to track it down. Did somebody say to you, I think she once appeared on a talk show on Channel 5?
It is that kind of thing. It's connecting the dots. You begin to find some footage. It's like excavation. And it's actually very exciting. That's one of the joys of making these films. And when you find this old footage, it's like a gift. It's magical.
Because there are things where she almost seems to make time stop. Suzanne Farrell once told me that she just kept on tipping over. And Balanchine said, well, just lean against the air. And somehow that clicked in her head. And from then on, she was perfectly fine.
Yeah. Balanchine had a way of inculcating in his dancers special abilities that they didn't even know they had. And he really, I mean, it's interesting because Balanchine also wanted to try to help Tanny walk when she was stricken with polio, just as he helped dancers do steps that they hadn't been able to do before. He was quite an inspired choreographer in that way.
Tanny was French by birth, at least her name would suggest it. But she doesn't speak with a French accent.
No, she moved to New York when she was three. Her father was French. He was a scholar, and he taught at one of the universities in New York. And her mother was from St. Louis. She was a socialite. So she really didn't – she spoke fluent French and a few other languages, but she had no accent.
And like many girls, she wanted to be a ballerina from the start?
She wasn't sure. She liked the ballet. She also took piano lessons, but as she says in our film, she was a dud at that. So she decided she would study the ballet. Her mother was quite a ballet mother, and so she continued to foster this. She tried to get Tanny into schools very early. Many schools wouldn't accept her because she was too young. But she eventually got into the School of American Ballet on a scholarship, and the rest was history.
But she didn't seem to go through that apprenticeship process where you dance in the corps and then you work your way into solo. She seemed to become a soloist from the start.
Well, she was so gifted, and I think Balanchine saw that. And I think that he was as mesmerized by her as we are today. She went from the School of American Ballet directly to her first solo role, dancing Colleric in the Four Temperaments. And there were other dancers who were dancing that. She was actually a soloist, they were principal dancers, and they weren't so happy about this young upstart coming in and having one of the lead roles. But she never did dance in the corps de ballet.
And then he started choreographing dances on her.
That's correct. Many.
Happens today? The people still dance them, but
they do.
Do they look at the old footage to try to capture the tonic skill?
Some of them do. I've spoken to some of those dancers, and they talk about how haunted they are by her and in some ways very intimidated.
Any of the more famous Balanchine dances?
Oh, many of them are. I mean, many of them have danced her dances. Well, Diana Adams, who's no longer alive, danced La Valse. Mm. And I was speaking with Wendy Whalen recently, and she's done a couple of parts. I can't remember exactly which ones. Allegra Kent did Symphony in C. So
La Valse almost is prescient in a very sad way.
Yes, there is a lot of strange eeriness around La Valse, which is about death coming to dance with the young maiden, and she falls in love with death and succumbs. There's also another prescient ballet that Balanchine choreographed for a March of Dimes fundraiser called Resurgence. And very strangely, Tanny danced the role of the victim, and Balanchine danced the role of polio.
And how long after that did she come down with polio?
Well, it was many years, but it was certainly close enough in time for them both to be very haunted by that experience.
Few people, aside from dancers of the time, have been able to see Tanny Kill a Clerk dance, but now you can, thanks to Nancy Bursky's documentary called Afternoon of a Faun, which opens tomorrow at Lincoln Center at the Eleanor Bunin Monroe Film Center. The name of the film is Afternoon of a Faun. Balanchine didn't choreograph that for
No, her. That's choreographed by Jerome Robbins. Tanny was a muse to both George Balanchine and Jerome Robbins. He was as fascinated and very much in love with her just as George Balanchine was.
You get the sense that, in a sense, he was in love with her, Otherwise, why would he have been so heartbroken when she married Balanchine? And yet, he was openly gay.
He was openly gay later in his life. In those years, he was seeing women. He had been engaged to two women. And whether or not that represented a true bisexuality or whether it was just his way of coping with gay at a time when it wasn't accepted, we really don't know that. But he was passionately fascinated by Tanny.
The Salk vaccine had already been developed at the time that that Tannehill was dancing. Why wasn't she inoculated?
First of all, most of that time span, most of the older dancers had missed getting the vaccine. You know, it was young people that got the inoculation. Remember, there was that huge test in the schools where so many young people got it. And after a certain age, most people who were stricken with polio were young. And so the effort was really to inoculate young people through that period. But before they left for Europe on that famous tour, they did offer the vaccine to many of the dancers, and most of them took it. But a few did not because they were concerned about feeling ill on their long plane trip, and Tanny was one of them who chose not to take the vaccine.
Well, she hadn't even wanted to go on the tour. Was she just tired?
I think she was tired. I think that she was having some problems in her marriage with George Balanchine. Balanchine was famous for finding many dancers quite interesting and fascinating, and so she was beginning to feel the effects of that, and she just wanted to stay home.
One of her predecessors was a guest on our show, Maria Tallchief. And I asked her why she was speaking so glowingly of Balanchine, considering the fact that he dumped her, I think, for Tanny. Or, well, somebody even...
No, it was Tanny, and I wouldn't say that he actually dumped her. I think, if anything, she may have dumped him. She was, I think, a little bit tired of a marriage that was rather unusual but not very normal.
Well, you'll have to explain that in a moment. But
okay.
She said, but he was a genius.
Yeah. Yes, I think that Barbara Horgan, who is Balanchine's former assistant, says in our film, all his wives left him. And she said, I can't speak to why, but perhaps it's hard to live with a genius.
Uh-huh. But, well, he does seem rather controlling. And after she is struck down, after Tanny is struck down, they were going to break up. He takes it upon himself to save her, to develop her muscles again in the hopes of having her dance again. But
well, I think it was a combination of things. I think, one, he was haunted by the role that some of his ballets played in her life, and he was somewhat superstitious. But I think Balanchine believed, as he did when he created a dance, that he could create Tanny to walk. He felt he had that power, or at least he hoped he had that power. And I think, thirdly, I think all of us would try to help someone walk again if they could, particularly your wife.
And she was just 27 years old. And
that's correct. It was a tragedy.
A great dancer.
Yeah.
You include many of her letters written to Jerry Robbins, where we hear her describe her deep depression, but always mixed with a bit of dark humor. For example, in one of them she asks, why do all the nurses have B.O.?
I know. Well, she was famously witty. And what was wonderful is the wit starts to reappear not too long after she's stricken. But let's also remember that in those first 6 months or so when she was in the hospital, she didn't know she would never walk again. I think she was hopeful that she would continue to get better and eventually she might be able to walk again. So she wasn't, I think, quite as depressed in that beginning period as she was later when she had to accept the fact that she would not walk or dance ever again.
Jerry Robbins doesn't always come across as the most lovable person in your film.
You know, I think he was an erratic friend. I think that he was, like many artists, very involved in his work, laser-focused. And we know many artists who are like Jerry that are kind of narcissistic when it comes to their lives in order to create. So I hope that our film isn't passing judgment on him. I just think it does show a man who is very preoccupied with his work as well as his friendships.
Well, he also had to have been a bit preoccupied by what was going on in his political life because he was called to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and He was one of the people who named names, and many people who had to work with him afterward, like Zero Mostel, said that caused a lot of difficulty for them.
That's right, and he wasn't alone. I think one of the reasons that he says he did name the names was because he didn't want to be outed at that time in his life. So all of this is actually quite connected, and it was a very painful time, and I think years later, when he looks back on it, he regrets it.
She finally does cut the cord with Balanchine.
It sounded to me like it was pretty mutual. She was tired of Balanchine paying attention to other women, and particularly he became fascinated with Suzanne Farrell, and she said, okay, he has to have his freedom. And so, ironically, she moved out of their apartment on a given day, and he moved out the same day.
A former dancer told me that it was painful for her to watch others dance after she left. But Tanny continued to remain involved in dance.
It's all about the timing. Initially, it was very painful for her. I've heard that she would look at her toe shoes and begin to cry, and she couldn't talk about dancing, and she couldn't go to the ballet. And then one day, she could go to the ballet.
And then Arthur Mitchell also got her involved. He seems to almost have been her savior.
In many ways, he was. You know, she really should have been teaching, and she loved coaching dancers in her ballets. And he suddenly realized, well, wait a minute, we don't need to coach one or two. We really need to instill what you know with many young dancers.
And by then, people were filming that sort of thing, so we actually have footage of her coaching some students.
They're actually stills. Huh. Yeah, we don't
in
have
her footage. Wheelchair.
That's correct.
But you did get some footage of her later in life.
Oh, yes, and that is from Martha Swope. Martha Swope is a well-known photographer of dance and of theater, and was a very close friend of Tanny's. And they traveled in Europe together, and she shot some wonderful footage.
And Tanny remains gorgeous throughout.
She does.
How old was she when she died?
She was 71.
So she lived a lot longer than anyone imagined she
would. The doctors predicted that she would not live past the age of 40, and she lived to 71. And as Randy Borscheid says so eloquently, that was that willfulness, that spirit, and a little bit of the orneriness that got her thrown out of class.
There will be various Q&As for the documentary tomorrow after the 6:45 show with Jacques D'Amboise and Randall Borscheid. Moderated by co-producer Rick Burns, and on Friday with Arthur Mitchell and Randall Borscheid following the 6:45 screening. My great thanks to Nancy Bursky, who directed, produced with Rick Burns, Afternoon of a Fawn, Tana Killa Clerk, premieres at the Eleanor Buna Monroe Film Center at Lincoln Center tomorrow. And if you want any information about tickets and schedules, you can go to our show page at wnyc.org. Let's listen to a little Debussy.